Welcome to Nerds at Church, a podcast about nerdery and the Bible. I'm Pastor Kay, and I use pronouns like she and her.
And I'm Pastor Emily, and my pronouns are they, them, theirs. In this episode, we'll discuss the first Sunday in Advent, also known as the beginning of the church year. Woohoo! Happy New Year!
Yay!
This year, the first Sunday of Advent falls on November 27th.
And welcome to Year A of the lectionary.
Yes. And as we begin this new church year, Year A in the Revised Common Lectionary, and our new and third season of Nerds at Church, we want to share a special shout out and thank you to our Patreon supporters. So thank you very much to our supporters, Bridget Watley,
Pace Warfield,
Aaron Holmgren,
Lori Kaiser-Boswell,
Jules and Claire Acklow,
Lowell Chilton,
and Juniper Linberry. Y'all are wonderful, and so much of what makes this podcast great would not be possible without you.
Yay. Also, check out the episode description for links to the Bible passages and other references we make in this episode.
For the start of this year, which is a year where the gospel will focus a lot on the Gospel of Matthew, Kay and I decided to do a deep dive into the Gospel of Matthew. I know. What a shock.
And the symbol for the Gospel of Matthew, much like the symbol for the Gospel of Luke, is the bull. For Matthew, it's the man. So Matthew is the animal, the man, instead of being the bull or the eagle or the lion. Okay.
Also, and Matthew is the man in both senses of the word.
Yeah, no, there is no, like,
you're the
gender
man, and also you are
equality here.
The
yeah.
man.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that Matthew is necessarily the establishment of the man, but
I don't know.
I suppose we'll figure that out this year. But what you may not know is that all of those symbols were assigned by St. Jerome in one of his commentaries on the Gospel of Matthew, which I thought was interesting. He assigned all four of them in his commentary on the Gospel of Matthew. So
nice. I did not know that until you told me 20 minutes ago. I mean, we prepare for these episodes well in advance.
Yes.
Totally.
But some of the trivia shows up at the last minute.
It's true. It's true. So the Gospel of Matthew, according to friend of the podcast, Pace Warfield, is basically the musical Godspell, but less fun. Like, if you want to get to know Matthew,
I mean,
watch
there could
Godspell.
Be dancing and music, just it's not written down. So
yeah. So feel free to, like, check out Godspell and then just, like, dial it back a notch on the fun. And there you will have the Gospel of Matthew.
Well, really, you should read the Gospel of Matthew and then watch Godspell, and then you can compare the two properly. Mm. Also, you'll have read the Bible, which is not necessarily something that, you know, we're against in this podcast. By all means, go ahead.
We tend to like the Bible and reading it and actually knowing what it says, you know.
Yeah, as opposed to what people says it says, which is a completely different question. Speaking of talking about the Bible, this gospel in particular was written sort of to the Jewish people, to the Jewish community. This gospel, when it talks about Jewish rituals and traditions, will not really explain those rituals and traditions the same way that they're explained in Luke, which was written to non-Jewish people. And so it kind of expects a certain knowledge of the Jewish cultural world at the time of Jesus. Also, perhaps not surprisingly, the title that is used the most often in the Gospel of Matthew for Jesus is the Messiah, which of course is his Jewish title. So that makes sense.
Yeah. Also, part of being written to Jewish people is that when the Gospel writer or Jesus refers to Jewish people, and in particular Jewish leadership, like the Pharisees, it is talking about the leadership of the community that it's talking to. It's not an excuse for anti-Semitism.
Right. There are no excuses for anti-Semitism.
Exactly. Also, one of the things that Matthew does is to really tie in a connection between Jesus and Moses. So it does that with, like, having the Holy Family flee to Egypt and then the calling your chosen one out of Egypt, right? Moses is called out of Egypt to help save the Hebrew people. Jesus and the Holy Family are called back out of Egypt after King Herod dies.
No, Emily, I think you'll find that Moses was called the Prince of Egypt, as in the musical. Speaking of musicals to watch while you're reading the Gospel of Matthew.
It's true. It's true. That actually, like, would be a pretty solid one. There's also a lot of, like, misquoting Hebrew scripture that happens. Matthew wants really badly to do the supersessionist, this is how Hebrew scriptures point towards Jesus, which is anti-Semitic, right? He's trying to make the connection for the particular people that he is a part of. When we do it as Christians, we are erasing and harming a whole tradition.
In the Gospel of Matthew, the Gospel writer most likely used the Septuagint, which is the Greek version of the Hebrew Scriptures, and so was translating from not the Hebrew into the verses for the Greek New Testament, but from the Greek translation of the Hebrew, and then using that to quote in the New Testament.
And so you get some, like, weird translations. And my favorite is occasionally they'll be paired up where, like, you'll have the actual what is being quoted as as an RCL reading and the Matthew version of it. And it's like,
those are not the same words, like, even in English. Yeah.
Right. So one of the clearest examples is this is where the virgin birth comes from. Matthew claims that it's quoting, I think, a passage in Isaiah, and that passage actually just talks about a young maiden, like a young woman. Matthew, because of the multi-translation thing, interprets it as the virgin birth, a virgin will bear a child. So it's stuff like that where you're just like, okay, riding on the colt and the foal, like the donkey and the colt, like both somehow Jesus rides on a donkey and a baby donkey at the same time.
I mean, you know, you need a footrest when you're riding side saddle, and I think that makes perfect sense, but yes.
Okay. I suppose I could see Jesus riding side saddle on the Palm procession for Palm Sunday.
Yeah, and the Gospel of Matthew was probably written about the same time as Luke, maybe around 90 AD or so, which would be between the Gospels of Mark, which was written earlier, and the Gospel of John, which was written later.
Mm-hmm. And Matthew uses both Mark and Q as a source. So Q is a source that Mark did not have access to, presumably, but that Luke did. So because Mark was written first, Mark has like this set of stories. And then Matthew and Luke both use a lot of those stories and kind of tweak them and adapt them. But they also use this other source because Matthew and Luke have a shared source that is not Mark. And that has been called the Q source. And so,
not necessarily the time-traveling character from Star Trek played by John DeLancey. Although, you know, we don't actually know.
It could be. Time travel.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Although I think if a 6-foot-tall white guy had showed up in ancient Palestine, we would have heard about it. But still.
I mean, the Nephilim? We kind of did.
I mean, he's not that tall. Like, I mean, you know, 6 feet is tall, but I don't know that, yeah.
Okay.
So the Gospel of Matthew starts off with Jesus's birth narrative. And we only really get two birth narratives for Jesus, one in Luke and one in Matthew. And the one in Matthew is the one that has the dream from Joseph and also the coming of the wise men or the magi, the wise people. To be fair, the exact wording in the Gospel of Matthew is debatable. I'm sure we'll probably talk about them again. And it also has a genealogy for Jesus that supposedly goes through Joseph, but both of the genealogies for Jesus go through Joseph, and it's not entirely clear on how that's supposed to work because they're notably different. And the Gospel of Matthew also includes the slaughter of the innocents immediately after Jesus's birth, probably when he was quite young, by King Herod.
Yes. Jesus also talks and teaches a lot in the Gospel of Matthew. It's not quite as bad as the Gospel of John, but it is a lot. And this is part of the connection with Moses, right? That there are these five big discourses of Jesus on discipleship, on what it means to follow Jesus, all of that stuff. And so you get those spread out throughout the gospel as like key moments, one of which is
the Sermon on the Mount, which takes place in this gospel instead of the Sermon on the Plain that we get in Luke. I don't know why, but for some reason my entire life I have always been mixing those up and thinking that the Sermon on the Mount happened in Luke and the Sermon on the Plain happened in Matthew. But remember, the Mount is in Matthew.
Yeah, I've never actually cared enough to know the difference. Yeah, I know that one is one, but
not especially me either. I would also say that while I have extensively talked about how much the Gospel of John and how the Gospel of John is worded irritates the crap out of me, I don't get that feeling with Matthew. I think in part because Matthew has Jesus as the one who's talking, and in the Gospel of John, it is the narrator of the Gospel of John that's talking, and I'm not here for him, you know? So...
That's fair. Also, there are still a lot of healings in Matthew. There's a shifting language a bit. So if you think about my favorite example is the Syrophoenician woman whose daughter Jesus begrudgingly heals in Mark becomes the Canaanite woman in Matthew 15, which also gives you a sense of the Gospel of Matthew is about twice as long as the Gospel of Mark. So yeah. there's just a lot more packed. Sure. And Jesus is a little bit less... human, and the disciples are a little bit less frustrating to Jesus in the gospel.
Which, you know, Jesus probably deserves a break now and then. Also, in this gospel, Peter, as sort of a character in the Bible, gets a little extra attention and a little more material about who he is and what he's like. And you'll find some of that in chapters 14, 16, and 18.
Yes. And so in... I think Luke, we heard a lot about the reign of God or the kingdom of God. In Matthew, it's more about the reign of heaven, the kingdom of heaven, that sort of thing.
Yeah. But essentially, so I think still being like the same thing. And I will also say, so that Emily doesn't have to say it, that Matthew does actually like binaries, both in terms of Jesus and other characters tend to compare contrast two things a lot. I want this and not that, that sort of thing. But also there's a bunch of contrast from the narrator between people or things or aspects of the world belonging to either God or the devil. That happens quite a lot.
Yeah.
Not all binaries have to be false, I suppose.
Yeah, and Matthew is the gospel that gives more details of the temptation in the wilderness after Jesus is baptized. So that's where Matthew is the one that has the details of the devil saying, or the one who tempts the devil, offering land and food and all of that stuff. So,
sure.
And then in the resurrection account, as with all of the rest of the four canonical gospels, women were at the resurrection first and were the first to announce the resurrection. So that's a similarity across all of the gospels.
That include the resurrection, aside from, say, Mark.
No, even Mark.
Because the long ending of Mark is crap. So we don't pay attention to that.
The long ending of Mark is crap. And still, the women, they go away scared. But they are the first ones at the resurrection.
Well, still, yes.
In Mark.
But I will take every opportunity to remind people to pay no attention to the long ending of Mark. So.
Oh, yeah. It's like Gilmore Girls, A Year in the Life. You just don't need it. And they just made it to make people happy.
Yeah.
And make more.
Like, if you want to call it canon, anyway. Well, actually, no, that's not fine. But still.
Yeah. Anyway. And then after the resurrection, the way that Matthew concludes is with Jesus sending the apostles in what is called the Great Commission, which is where Jesus says, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you. And remember, I am with you always to the end of the age." So a lot of the particular baptism wording that some churches are more strict about than others of being baptized in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit and not using any other deviations of those names is from this Great Commission in Matthew.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kay, do you have a favorite thing or a least favorite thing about Matthew?
I don't actively dislike the Gospel of Matthew. It's right up there with the Gospel of Mark in terms of being a very middling gospel to me. There are parts of it that I actively like, but I would say that the only thing that frustrates me about it is that during the year that we read from Mark in the Revised Common Lectionary, I always mentally have to reserve about a third of my time during sermons to explaining the Jewish background that Matthew does not give. If I'm preaching on the gospel, there is a large chunk of my sermon that will be explaining stuff that we don't understand because we don't have that cultural background. And in the other years, I don't have to do that anywhere near as often. So I don't necessarily mind, but it means that my sermons are like effectively shorter.
Yeah, that is a good point. And it's important to explain those details in that context. And a great extra reason we really should be paid by the Jewish Annotated New Testament for all of the advertising we give to it. But
I really don't think they do need to pay us, because like Christianity owes Judaism kind of a lot by this point, and also, for a lot of reasons.
Also true.
So
yeah, but it's important to pay attention to that context. Yeah, because one of my favorite gospel passages is the Syrophoenician woman in Mark. I also have a deep affection for the Canaanite woman in Matthew and that story. But I also just like the eye roll things of translation. I'm just like, ugh. Matthew is my fourth favorite of the canonical gospels. So
okay.
Showing my hand there. But yeah. Okay. If Matthew were a Muppet.
Oh, goodness. If Matthew were a Muppet. You know, in terms of understanding a lot of stuff that we don't understand, and also like being visibly human rather than a particular type of animal, I would say that the guy from the band, Dr. is obviously seeing a lot of stuff that we don't see in the Muppets, and also is a human rather than an animal.
That makes sense. I was thinking Stettler and Waldorf.
Possibly, sure.
Possibly, because there's like...
maybe one or the other. I mean, yeah. Matthew doesn't bicker with itself.
Right. But like one of them, because there's a lot of like knowing a lot more, and then also just like a teeny bit annoying, and also... yeah, it just feels like Stettler or Waldorf.
Absolutely. So our first reading for this episode is from Isaiah chapter 2, verses 1 through 5. The prophet Isaiah proclaims the coming of the establishment of God's house in the highest mountains and an end to war.
So one of the themes in this passage is ways to avoid war. In this case, the way to avoid war is to have God decide things. And so then there's kind of an external judge or decider, arbiter of things. In the West Wing, and according to Toby, free trade is the way to avoid war, because as long as they have vested economic interests in each other, countries are less likely to go to war, which is complicated because free trade is not the same thing as fair trade.
No. But also, like, I am a firm believer in when in doubt, make it clear to someone that it's in their best interest for them to not go to war. And that's basically what he's trying to do. It's just that it's not always as effective as he would like.
It's true. Yeah. And then as we dive into the verses, in verse 2, we read, "In days to come, the mountain of the Becoming One's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be raised above the hills. All the nations shall stream to it." So the Becoming One's house shall be in the Himalayas? Or if it's on this continent, in this country, my beloved Rockies, also known as the Shining Mountains, according to the Ute, we're just going to move it up to, like, make it the tallest, put it on top of the tallest mountain.
Yeah. This is also an excellent illustration of the difference between the two of us, because while I also grew up visiting the Rockies regularly, and I do care about them, my first thought for this was more that I wanted to clarify, it's that the tops of the mountains are raised above the tops of the hills. It's not that the bottoms of the mountains will be raised above the tops of the hills, because my instant mental image for this was when the SimCity terrain tool used to glitch and you would have these floating hills or mountains. And that was always a mess. So that is not what God is going for. That would be awkward.
That makes sense. Although when we get to John the Baptist's introduction, we might have other things to say about it, because there is a leveling of the land in that one.
True, yeah. And then in verse 3, we read, "Many people shall come and say, 'Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, and to the house of the Lord of the God of Jacob, that God may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth instruction, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem.'" And I listen to this and I think to myself, doesn't this sound like an orienteering or an outdoor skills course to anyone else? Like, you're going up the mountain, you are going to be taught their ways. I'm expecting Yosemite Sam to come out of nowhere and teach me how not to fall down a mountain, which, like, if you're on a mountain already, that seems like good advice. I'm in favor.
Yeah, but, and Smokey the Bear to, like, teach you how not to start a forest fire.
Yes, mm-hmm. exactly. Mm-hmm. Sure. Because remember, kids, Jesus says, don't set people on fire.
Murder
bad.
Bad. I know that we're probably the only ones that get that much delight out of that catchphrase, but I love it. And then in verse 4, we read, God shall judge between the nations and shall arbitrate for many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. And this reminded me of, at first I was thinking about like Iron Man versus Captain America, where Iron Man uses fancy technology to create basically swords and spears, weapons.
Sure.
Whereas Captain America, the fancy technology goes toward a shield, which is decidedly not supposed to defensive. Be a weapon. Yeah, it's defensive. But then I was thinking about it even further. And if you add in Wakanda, and they do some swords and spears, and they do some shields, but they also do plowshares and pruning hooks. They also use it for creation and nurturing and creating sustenance for their community.
Yeah, very much for the community and not just for violence. Yeah.
Yeah. It helped that they were pretty isolationist for a while. But.
Well, yeah.
And then our second reading for this episode is Romans chapter 13, verses 11 through 14. Paul invites us to wake to the dawn of Christ's coming return and to clothe ourselves with Christ in our daily actions. So one of the themes in this passage is the life that we live in the waiting time. So I didn't realize how good this was as a comparison until I started getting into it, but in the show Travelers, people's consciousnesses are sent back into particular moments in history to try to change history. And when they come at the moment that someone is supposed to die, and then they keep living that person's life as if they hadn't died while also doing these like side tasks and missions and stuff. And so Grant McLaren, one of the main characters, keeps living a married life after he basically changes consciousness.
Okay.
But because he is actually a different person, he lives a decidedly different life, and then that makes a big difference in his relationship with his wife and that sort of thing. And so there's this, like, you are continuing in this waiting time and also living differently, but also still living.
So does this mean that his wife is, like, non-consensually married to someone else than who she married?
A little bit, yeah.
What it sounds like. Okay. Hmm.
Yeah, it's a complicated thing.
Okay.
Because it's just, like, the consciousness of the person, and so it's like still the same body. And yeah,
I have to say, if somebody replaced my husband's consciousness with someone else's, I would be pretty pissed. So, but
well, and they do it when the person is supposed to have died, so it is complicated. Yeah. But also, like,
right,
that person, it's not like they're replacing someone who was supposed to be alive still.
Right. Okay. So in verse 11, the first part of the verse, we read, besides this, you know what time it is, how it is now the moment for you to wake from sleep. So contrary to what it might sound like here, Jesus is not actually an alarm clock. Please do not smack Jesus. Believe me, I've read enough of the Bible that I understand the impulse, but still, don't smack Jesus. Even if you have gotten into a Groundhog Day-like scenario, just make friends with the groundhog and be nice to Minnie Driver, and you'll be fine. Like, when in doubt, you know, make friends with animals and don't be mean to Minnie Driver. That seems like a fairly decent piece of life advice.
Seems pretty standard. Yeah, that's fantastic.
Robbing an armored car, probably a bad life choice. Just saying.
Right. I was looking at the second half of that verse, and particularly where it says, for salvation is nearer to us now than when we became believers. And my immediate response is always, well, yeah, of course it is. You lived longer, so you're closer to the end of the thing. That is basically always true about everything that is coming up in the future. Unless you're in the TARDIS, in which case it's a bit more wibbly wobbly. Like, it's still kind of true, but also kind of not. And wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey stuff.
Time is an illusion.
Sure. Indeed.
And then the second part of verse 12, we read, "Let us then lay aside the works of darkness and put on the armor of light." And okay, I'm going to acknowledge the whole light and darkness wording here is complicated and you can do a lot of different interesting things with it. But also, like, please don't put on armor made out of light at night without consent from those around you, because if someone is trying to sleep, they are not going to be happy with you at all, right? Like, that's just going to completely screw up their circadian rhythms. And if they happen to be members of the Fae from the October Day series, they're going to be really angry if you mess with their circadian rhythms because they're nocturnal, and having this gigantic, you know, brightly lit person around covered in armor is going to be kind of weird for them. So
also, it's going to be like impossible for me to look at the stars and go stargazing, so please don't do it around me. I sure do not give consent.
Also, if it's, you know, armor made out of light, I'm guessing it's going to be pretty hard to look at you too. So actually, I suppose if you're trying to avoid social interaction, that's not a bad plan. But
that took whole turns that I did not anticipate. Sure.
I don't know that an armor made out of light is going to be particularly effective as armor, unless there's something else to it. But
I mean, it was effective for Gandalf.
True.
When he became true. Gandalf the White instead of Gandalf the Grey, and they like tried to attack him, and it was literally light.
And that whole wave, like, of sunlight thing that, at the battle. Sure.
So somewhat effective. Yeah. And then in verse 13, we read, "Let us live honorably as in the day, not in reveling and drunkenness, not in debauchery and licentiousness, not in quarreling and jealousy." So let's not do the whole sexuality without any care for the person bit, which is basically what Westworld is pre-rebellion, where it was literally created so that humans could do whatever they wanted to the artificial intelligence without any care for them as humans.
Right.
Which, like, partly they were not human, but also, like, as they continued to develop, they developed actual, like, intelligence and personality, right, and those sorts of things. And so then the, like, focus on humans' personal gratification really came at the expense of other creatures with sentience. And that's what Paul's, like, not such a fan of.
Yeah. I don't consider myself a terribly superstitious person, but I do find myself being polite to, like, technology on the theory that if technology ever does wind up developing an AI, then having it like me would be good.
That's true.
Also, it just seems to, like, cultivate a more positive outlook on life and the world in some ways. Mm-hmm. But I can't deny that there's a certain amount of concern in there. So maybe I've just read too much science fiction. And then our gospel passage for this episode is from the Gospel of Matthew. I know. Are you shocked?
No way.
From chapter 24, verses 36 through 44. Jesus, describing his eventual return, insists that it will be unexpected by everyone. The changes it brings will be extraordinary, and we are to remain alert for Jesus' arrival.
So one of the themes from this passage is the idea of eschata, or the individual word would be eschaton, which is a Greek word. So we're going to do a little bit of, like, Greeking out. But eschata, or an eschaton, is a particular moment in time that is kind of like at the edge of something. It's at the edge of going one way or another. And a lot of what Matthew is focusing on is, like, and what Jesus is talking about are, this thing is coming and things will go one way or the other. The Left Behind series and those sorts of groups tend to make it the end times. But that's not necessarily what it is. It is a decisive time where things go in one direction or another.
Sure.
Those happen all the time.
And I think in the Star Wars universe, those are called shatter points. And Mace Windu has a special ability to sort of see through them and see the possibilities.
Ooh, nice. Doctor Who doesn't have them, but has, like, the opposite of, like, no matter what you do, this person must die on this day or something like that. Travelers, the show, again, is really based on this exact thing, right? Like, they initially are getting sent back into time to stop this asteroid called Helios 685 from hitting the Earth. And that takes Earth and humanity in particular in a whole different direction. And then there's a new thing that happens because some people that were killed weren't killed. And so they come up with this thing and that leads in another direction and that leads in another direction. And so you get this, like, the timeline between the future, who is sending people back, and the present, who is receiving those people. Like, there's this, like, shifting. And as one thing changes, then the future changes, and then they have to respond to another thing. And
sure.
I like Asanta and time. Someday we'll dive deeper into time. Then we'll really freak our listeners out.
Oh, that sounds exhausting, but maybe, sure.
And then in verses 40 and 41, we read, Jesus says, "Then two will be in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together, one will be taken and one will be left." So basically, Jesus is describing Thanos in the Avengers, turning half of all of the, like, animals, creatures, living things to dust to, like, control the population. Maybe they won't be turned into dust in Jesus' version, though.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Jesus' version is that we don't actually know which one of those options is good, or, like, if one of them is better than the other. And kind of that's also true with the snap with Thanos, because, like, on the one hand, you could skip all that pain and suffering that half the world goes through. But on the other hand, you also disappear and miss a lot of stuff.
Yeah. And also, false binary. Does one have to be good and one have to be bad? I don't know. Probably because it's Matthew, but false binary. False binary.
Yeah, just stop Thanos from doing that in the first place. Like, anyway. And then in verse 42, we read, "Keep awake, therefore, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming." And I'd really like to rephrase this as "keep alert." Like, that might not be the literal way that it's phrased in the language originally, but alert is good, but please don't go for actual full-on sleep deprivation. That leads to bad and scary places. The Leverage episode, The Experimental Job, shows exactly what that can do to a person, and basically it just never helps. So naps are good, and you should have some.
There's a reason why that is, like, sleep deprivation is considered torture.
Yeah.
And it's illegal to
get your rest. It's important.
And then in verse 43, we read, "But understand this, if the owner of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, the owner would have stayed awake and would not have let their house be broken into." Which, like, okay, but what would the owner have actually done? Would the owner have just, like, surprise attacked the thief ahead of time? Or perhaps taken a page out of Les Mis's book and just given the thief all of the things, including the silver candlesticks, which they would have forgotten otherwise.
Aww.
I mean, part of it is that most people who steal things on small scales are stealing because they're out of options. So give them a bunch of money and maybe they will make
other choices. It's complicated. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then in verse 44, we read, "Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour." And I personally like the theory that this means that if anyone, like, really anyone at all, expects that Jesus might come back at a certain time or on a certain day, then Jesus won't. And so therefore, Jesus will only show up when we all stop finally freaking out about it, which would be nice. But also, like, I'm not too worried about Jesus showing up tomorrow, because there's a lot of people who are freaked out about it right now. And so probably somebody's expecting that. So that's not going to happen.
Yeah. I like this plan.
I'm hoping overall that this means that Jesus showing up unexpectedly will be less like Monty Python's Spanish Inquisition, which no one ever expects, and more like Nick Fury showing up at the end of the first Iron Man movie, partly because, like, no one actually needs another Spanish Inquisition, and also I don't really see Jesus being the wacky slapstick comedy kind of guy, but I suppose maybe. Again, there's probably a lot of stuff that didn't get written down in the Gospels.
Like, palm procession, he definitely seems a bit slapsticky trying to ride two animals at once.
That could be fun, sure. But also, when Nick Fury shows up at the end of the first Iron Man movie, that is sort of a big, obvious clue that something more, something important is on the way. And that seems like a very Jesus thing to do. Yeah. If Jesus also wants to show up as Samuel L. Jackson with one eye, I suppose that's an option. Like, okay, sure.
True.
You know, we had cast Samuel L. Jackson as Moses, but whatever, sure.
I mean, if we're in the Gospel of Matthew, Moses and Jesus, two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, exactly.
That's fantastic. And now for our wackiest segment, let's make a Muppets musical. We already have cast our choices for the Gospel of Matthew as a Muppet, but if we're casting the actual stories that we're reading and the passages, who are you casting this week, Kay?
Well, let's see. First, I tried the prophet Isaiah, and I was trying to think of, are there any, like, mountain-climbing Muppets? And Yosemite Sam really was the closest I could come up with. I don't think there really were.
Big Bird climb a mountain? Maybe not the best.
I suppose. I don't really remember any scenes where there was mountain climbing.
Yeah. Now you've got me casting The Sound of Music as a Muppets musical.
I went there too. And like, honestly, a Muppet version of The Sound of Music. I mean, they do have the Lonely Goat Herd puppet bit, I suppose, in that movie, which is not all that close, but the goat herd is definitely on a mountain, so that's a start. But yeah, that was not getting me anywhere. And then I was thinking about the Romans passage, and all that talk about the dawn made me think of the sun from the Teletubbies, which, like, I am not going there. I refuse. No. And
but you just
Nope. We're not casting anything from the Teletubbies in our Muppet section. I refuse. And so then instead I tried to go to the gospel and thinking about being alert and being ready. And I don't know about the alert part, but in terms of being ready, Fozzie Bear is always ready to tell a joke. Like, he has one ready all the time, right? That is not something you can catch him out on. So I don't know that it's exactly the kind of ready that Jesus is talking about, but it's a kind of ready.
It's true. Yeah, I was thinking about it, and I was thinking about the gospel and the count.
Because
the count would be counting to one and counting to two, and then counting to one again. Yes. There are one, two people. Oh, now there is one person.
And he would always be ready to count how many people there were. Yes.
Exactly. Always ready, that count.
Thanks for joining us. Catch us next time when we'll discuss nerdery connections to the scripture readings for the second Sunday of Advent. This podcast has been produced by us, Kay Roloff and Emily Ewing. For more fun, check us out on Twitter and Facebook at nerdsatchurch, or contact us at nerdsatchurch@gmail.com.
Also, if you like what you've heard, rate us or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, or wherever you catch your podcasts. If you want access to our uncut guest episodes and interviews, live Q&As, and more, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nerdsatchurch. It's cheaper than a Twitter blue check. Or also the entirety of Twitter, at least for another couple days. Twitter might be cheaper soon. We'll see.
I look forward to finding out. Also, let us know on Facebook or, if it's still there, Twitter, who you would cast for Let's Make a Muppets Musical for this episode.
As the ancient Christian said,
Pax Vobiscum.